It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and today it's our trip to New Orleans, the Big Easy. We're taking you into the food world of this city that's like no other. Nowhere else feels like New Orleans, eats quite like New Orleans, honors the cocktail the way New Orleans always has, or celebrates people's histories the way New Orleans has. And of course, New Orleans endures, and it seems it endures no matter what. Their food and stories are inseparable, and we've discovered some gems, so stay with us. We're heading into kitchens, markets, and bars with some of the city's most intriguing people and some of its best food. That's this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, this show is all New Orleans, the Big Easy, the town that keeps coming back no matter what Mother Nature throws at her, and the town with food like no place else. Last spring, we joined Jane and Michael Stern there for their annual Road Food Festival, and we did some feasting and exploring on our own, so we've got a traveler's guide of sorts with some of the New Orleans people who make food happen there and have some unexpected stories to tell. Now, when Chef Leah Chase talks, people listen. People like politicians, activists, and leaders. At 89, Leah Chase is the civil rights pioneer, part of the soul of New Orleans, and the queen of Creole cuisine. She's still cooking at her Dookie Chase restaurant, named for her husband. It's a landmark of the Treme neighborhood. That's the oldest African-American community in America, and it's the star of the HBO series. Now, sure enough, the day we met, Leah came out of the kitchen with her chef's jacket smeared with flour. She was prepping for the dinner service. She's 89. But as far as age goes, little shows on Ms. Chase's face, and that's what most people call her, out of respect. Her restaurant, though, is old New Orleans elegance. White tablecloths, good silver, Victorian chairs. But the art is something else. Every wall is hung with African-American works. It's her famous collection, and she's got a personal connection to each piece. So when we settled in, I asked her how this all started.
Well, when I came to New Orleans, I came up in a small town across the lake. And when I came here to work, I was, 18 and 41. And I went to work as a waitress in the French Quarters. So when I came here, I thought I was going to be a waitress too, you know. But they didn't have anybody in the kitchen. I wanted to change things because you got to know in the African-American community, people did not eat in restaurants. The African-Americans did not eat in restaurants. They didn't.
This was because of the issues of color?
Well, we couldn't go to the big restaurants, and you didn't know what was in them unless you worked in them like I did. So you never went in them, and you cooked at home. And the Creoles of color particularly entertained at home. So when I came in, I said, oh, no, we're going to change from fried shrimp, fried oysters, fried fish. That's what they had on the menu. And my mother-in-law used to sit down and write the menu by hand. You know, she had about four or five items. And I said, we're going to change this. We're going to make it just like I see on the other side of town. Well, my dear, that wasn't easy. That was not easy. Because in the 40s, you got to set, people were making money in the 40s. You know, it was wartime. People uh-huh. were making money. And she was making money doing what she was doing. But I just thought we should have a nicer restaurant. And people didn't understand that because they had never been into any of them.
So how did they react when you had this restaurant? I understand, white tablecloths?
Yeah, when I came in, you know, they had, they were using plastic or nothing on the table. and you would come in, they would serve you a plate. Maybe none would match, just that kind of thing. Oh, no. I said, oh, no, we have to change.
But it did catch on.
It did. You know, and then here comes integration. So my clientele here was always, I guess, what you'd call the creme de la creme. You know, the finest Creoles of color, the this, the that, the other. So they were the ones who were going to go into integrated spaces. They were the ones who were going to be able to go and try out the hotels and that kind of thing. So they said, well, I think y'all should move, because we had the project across the street, you know, and I think you should move. And I couldn't understand that. I couldn't figure that one out. You can't run away from yourself. You are who you are. And I could go from here to Timbuktu and change me. So, and I said, no, we're going to stay right on this corner, and you make it work. And that's what we did, stay right on this corner. And the, we had across the street were public housing. Uh-huh. Some of the people were great people. They had older people that had been there since 1941. But then you had some drug addicts. You had all kinds of people over there. But you know what? They were always good to me. They were always good. They were like my policemen. You know, they knew, we even when we had nothing but the bar, my father-in-law was a stickler of how people dressed to come out. You know, he wouldn't let you in if you didn't look right or if you talked too loud and all that kind of stuff. So they knew that. They wouldn't come in here to get a sandwich to go if they didn't have a shirt on and some shoes on. They would never come. So if they would see somebody come in, they'd say, Miss Dickie, somebody going in your dining room. Do you know they're going in your dining room? They have shorts on. So they were like my bodyguards. I miss them very much.
I understand that during the whole segregation and integration movement, that this was one of the centers in New Orleans.
Yes.
Tell me about that period.
Well, we had, you know, we were like everybody else in the black community, working with the NAACP, trying to get things to change with Thurgood Marshall and A.P. Turow, Dutch Morial, all those people were big NAACP people. And we were trying to, you know, be accepted without hurting anybody. Mm-hmm. And in the 60s, here come these young people, bam, they're just going to go in there and break no down. They're going to take chances, go to jail if they have to. We couldn't understand that. But it worked. You know, it was, some mistakes were made, a lot of mistakes were made. But sometimes that's what it takes to change a system.
And they did a lot of that here.
They did the planning here, you see, over a bowl of gumbo, some fried chicken. Then they would go out, go to jail, maybe some of them, and do whatever to make a difference in what you ought to do.
I understand that your dish, that you mentioned the gumbo, mm-hmm. nourishing the integration movement with your gumbo, but mm-hmm. that dish is evidently pretty famous.
Yes, it is.
Tell me what that's about.
Well, that's typical Creoles of color. They do nothing. They don't have any festive dinner unless you start with gumbo. You must start that dinner with gumbo. I don't care what else you have after. If it's Christmas, if it's Thanksgiving, you may get to the table with your family at 12 noon. And you know what you have at 12 noon? You have this big bowl of gumbo. Maybe you'll have two bowls of gumbo. Always with some wine. Never have gumbo without wine. Then you'd move away from the table, and you'd have drinks, and you'd talk. Then you'd go back to the table at about 2 in the afternoon and have the rest of your dinner, which could be ever and anything, you know, different seasons you'd have in everything. And then there you'd stay until you got tired.
You've been cooking all of your life, and you're still cooking now.
Mm-hmm.
But you've done so much else. I mean, you're famous for your involvement in the arts. You're famous for your involvement in the community. What's really important to you now? Is there one thing you could pick out? What's important to you?
Living. I love living. Now, you can live or you can exist. I hate when people just exist. You know, they get up in the morning, they brush their teeth, they wash their face, they eat a breakfast, and they go on, and they come back home, and the next day, same thing. I call that existing. To live now is something else. You have to be around people. You have to do for other people every day. Do something every day, anyway, for somebody else. That's what I call living. And I love living. And that's what keeps me going. I love people. I love living. And I like what I do because everybody has to eat. And you can get to anybody's heart over a bowl of gumbo, over some good food. You can do that.
Well, thanks for having us at the restaurant.
Thank you so much.
I went to Duke a chance to get something to eat. The waiter looked at me and said, Ray, you sure look beat now.
Leah Chase and her husband Dookie have the Dookie Chase Restaurant in New Orleans. Now, find one of her gumbo recipes on the website, splendidtable.org. My idea of a great time in New Orleans is sitting down with something long and cool in a glass and talking with Lolas Eric Eli. This man's mind is amazing. It ranges over so much. But New Orleans is his first love, and he knows it inside out. Lolas is a journalist, a food writer, and a filmmaker. He works on that HBO series, Tremé. And he's done a documentary, Faubourg Tremé, The Untold Story of Black New Orleans. It's a stunner. Well, I got my wish. Lolas and I got together over some lemonade and talked New Orleans, starting with what's happening on the food scene right now.
One of my complaints about food in New Orleans for years had been that to go to a reasonably priced place, say like, you know, $10 and $20 for dinner, you had Asian places, you had Lebanese places, but no American places. Uh-huh. That's kind of changed to some extent. There are a few places now. The place we're at today, Hi-Hat, is one example. A couple of other places that have sort of filled that niche of quality food, not white tablecloth, and not fine dining prices. The other aspect of it, though, is we focus a lot on why we're different from the rest of the South, which I think is valid and important, is one thing that has kept us so interesting. But there's a whole lot of this tradition that is very much part and parcel of the rest of the South, or perhaps I should say the rest of the South's plural. For example, grits. It's a staple in New Orleans, just as it is around the rest of the region. Cornbread, same thing. Fried chicken, same thing. And a lot of the things that you'd come to New Orleans for are not those things you can also get in Mississippi and Alabama, but nonetheless, they're the things that people fix at home on a consistent basis. So part of it is reconnecting us to those aspects of our tradition. For example, gumbo. In New Orleans, Christmas, Thanksgiving, and a whole lot of other holidays, gumbo is the first course. Even though it's big enough and hearty enough to be a meal, it's gumbo, and then the turkey and the dressing, etc. Well, fine dining places here have always had gumbo on the menu. Same with etouffees and other kinds of dishes. I think there has always been more of a dialogue between home cooking and fine dining in New Orleans than in most of the rest of the country.
Since Katrina, there's been major changes in the restaurant world. What was the effect?
I'm not certain that we can look at these trends as being directly because of the flood, because there's aspects of this that reflect what's going on in the rest of the country. The idea is that here it is, you're a fine dining chef, but you really don't have the money to open a fine dining restaurant. And so perhaps you open a food truck or something less formal. Tom Fitzmaurice kept a list of the new restaurants opening up. And what was striking to me, he argues that there are more restaurants now than there were prior to the storm, despite the fact we have less of a population. But it's also striking to me how many of these fine dining restaurants are opening. And the fact that they haven't closed suggests to me that they're at least marginally profitable. As you know, restaurant business, you know, it's not the best way to make a lot of money.
No, you don't tell your banker you're going into the restaurant
right,
business.
Right. Yeah. And part of it is that the people most apt to come back were the people with the most disposable income. The Greater New Orleans Data Center says that about 10% of our current population came here since the levee failures. And so in that way, all these new people coming in, wanting to go to these restaurants, I think contributes to the strength of the restaurant economy.
But what about the loss to people who couldn't afford those restaurants? What about the loss of that entire group of people who couldn't afford to come back? That's a tremendous loss in a whole other area of food and culture.
It's incalculable. As an example, the city council here in 2008 voted to demolish the major public housing complexes. And it was the usual argument, so those people lazy, et cetera, et cetera. What folks missed was the fact that there was public housing meant that there were people who could afford to work as dishwashers and as cooks in restaurants that weren't paying them so much.
Uh-huh.
And we were, in that sense, subsidizing these businesses, the hotels with the people making beds for little or no money. We were subsidizing that. And these people were working. That's the kind of thing that's often missed in this equation.
Mm-hmm. Lolis, you write for the HBO series Tremé, which is about a particular neighborhood of New Orleans. And in this television show, there's a lot about the food scene here in New Orleans. And how is it playing out in the show?
Well, food is a big part of the culture here. And by having a chef as a main character, it gave us entree into the world of food in New Orleans. But in addition to the fact that she's doing this cooking, first season in New Orleans, second season in New York, we also focus on people eating and cooking in other contexts. Our characters from out of town go and discover New Orleans restaurants. So it really is a celebration of New Orleans food. And by the same token, I think we're able to fictionalize an aspect of restaurant life that you don't see on all these other cooking shows. And mind you, Anthony Bourdain writes the storylines for Jeanette Desautels, who's our chef character.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of what he's doing is taking all the things he's either seen, heard, or experienced and putting them into one nightmare for her. He's unwilling to relive these things, but he has no problem making her relive them. And fortunately, what everyone tells me is that the restaurant world has gotten a lot more professional in the days since he was cooking. In the last 20 years or so, you're not automatically signing on to be tortured if you go to work in a fine dining kitchen. So in some ways, we're playing an aspect of this culture that is fortunately past, but it's still funny and fun.
It's a fascinating series, and I'm looking forward to seeing how this season is going to roll out for us. So, hey, thanks for talking with us.
Lynn, it has been a pleasure. Come back to New Orleans anytime.
Oh, I will.
Hanging in a Tremé, watching people sashay, past my steps, by my porch, in front of my door.
Lolis Eric Eli is an award-winning New Orleans journalist, food writer, and filmmaker. Well, we're going to be back with New Orleans culinary dynamo Poppy Tooker and its king of the cocktail. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Poppy Tooker is the host of Louisiana Eats on WWNO in New Orleans. Now, if I could channel Poppy into my house every morning, I'd never have a bad day. This woman is a flamboyant dynamo. And if you want to know about the lost dishes of New Orleans, get to Poppy Tooker. We met up in her kitchen. She had the coffee pot on, her three pugs were lined up on the couch, and Poppy had on her trademark bright red lipstick and food-shaped jewelry. On the stove were a couple of cast iron pots.
Well, everybody comes to New Orleans and thinks that the thing to do is to go to the French Market and have beignets and café au lait. And they never even learn about the calas. So we're going to have calas, which are similar to beignets, but better with a more interesting history.
Now, what exactly is a calas?
It's a rice cake. And if you were to go to Africa today, to Ghana or Liberia, you would find the women in the open-air markets making calas. So this is a dish that actually made the trip across the Atlantic Ocean with the rice-growing slaves who were brought here because we didn't know how to grow rice. And the calas became a very important part of the New Orleans history. And we are talking about the time before the Louisiana Purchase, which of course happened in 1803. The city was ruled by the Code Noir. And in the Code Noir, it laid out all the regulations for how the white people, the slaves, and the free people of color lived here together. And what a lot of people don't appreciate is that the free people of color owned property. They were educated. They were doctors and lawyers. They sent their kids for higher education to Europe. It was a very different climate than in the rest of the United States. So in the Code Noir, there are two rules. Number one, all slaves are required by law to have at least one day a week off. So the slave's day off most often was Sunday. And many of them would become street vendors. And they would call out, Kala, Kala, Belle Kala Touchot, Madame, Belle Kala Touchot, which means beautiful Kala is very hot. The other thing in the Code Noir that I really believe reflects on the Kala tradition is it said if a slave came to you, demanded his price, and could pay it, then you were required by law to take his money and let him go. So undoubtedly, it was this historic rice cake that actually ended up buying freedom for many of them and their families. And I'd say that's a lot more interesting and historic than some old beignet.
Yes, talk about having positive baggage. Yeah. So how do you make it?
Okay, this is what we do. We eat more rice here in southern Louisiana than just about any place else except for Asia. So we've always got some leftover rice in the refrigerator. We're going to start off with 2 cups of leftover cooked rice. And to those 2 cups of rice, we're going to add 6 tablespoons of flour and 2 teaspoons of baking powder. And then 3 heaping tablespoons of sugar, and we mix the dry ingredients together, and then we're going to sprinkle on a little bit of vanilla.
Uh-huh.
And then for the binding agent, we add 2 raw eggs, and this is going to make a nice tight batter.
It's not a soft batter, let's put it this way.
No.
And this is going to be pretty easy to shape, right?
Oh, yeah. And as a matter of fact, when it comes to shaping it, my preferred method is with a pair of tablespoons, like oval soup spoons.
Right.
Okay, I'm going to get 2 spoons.
Okay, so we're going to go over to the stove.
Yeah.
And you've got a big cast iron pot.
Yeah.
Oil.
Check and make sure that we've got a good frying temperature.
So what did you just do now?
I just dropped a grain of rice in, and pretty much if the grain pops up to the top and starts bubbling, then we're all set.
And all you've done is you've taken a heaping tablespoon of the batter, and you've put it into the tablespoon,
yeah.
And then the other tablespoon is sort of spooning over it, and you've formed almost an oval. Well, it's mm-hmm. an oval, but it has a triangular shape to it. You
yeah.
keep just shaping it.
And then it's ready to go off into the hot oil. Okay, so you just spoon it gently into the hot oil.
Right.
And then it pops up to the top, and it begins to fry. The really great thing with the Kala is that they're foolproof. They're obedient. And, you know, there's not very many obedient foods. When you put them in the pot, they brown on one side, and then they turn themselves over and brown on the other. So you don't have to mind them.
Oh, it's puffing up a bit, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's that leavening going to work. How long are they going to take to?
They're just going to take until they're brown on both sides. And did you see it just turn over?
I sure did. Yes, okay, it just flipped its little old self right
let's
over.
Let's do another one so that you
okay.
can see that. And, you know, I'm going to tell you, the reason why I have been on this crusade to save the Kala and bring it back is because over 20 years ago, I did a festival and I knew how to make them, but I hadn't grown up with them and I didn't know how special a part of the culture they really were here until an old man came up to the booth and he said to me, "Lady, my mama used to make these all the time when I was a little boy, and I had completely forgotten all about that until just now. Could you please tell me, how do you make these?" And it was so clear in this mm-hmm. man's face that the taste of the Kala had brought his mother back alive to him. And, you know, it doesn't matter what race or religion or nationality you are. The thing that makes us all human is that we all have to eat to live. And the place where we all come together is at the table. So I set out to save the Kala. And I did it by talking about it in cooking classes, by telling anybody in the food world who would listen. And we really started to make some traction. And then about 10 years ago, I started making them savory style. And it caught the attention of some local chefs, and it started showing up on restaurant menus. And you can find savory calas at Frank Brightson's restaurant. You can find them at Cochon, at Steven Strajewski and Donald Link's restaurant. And so they're helping me do what my little great-grandmother used to say, which was, Poppy, eat it to save it. Now, Mama meant clean your plate.
Right,
but
right.
In the work that I've been involved in, it makes all the more sense, because if we don't eat it, how are we going to save it?
So this
is... So are you ready to taste?
I am ready to taste.
Well, as soon as they're cool enough.
And so, oh, they look gorgeous.
Oh, they are delicious.
They really look gorgeous.
So here, we're going to sprinkle them with some powdered
Sifting
sugar.
Sifting some powdered sugar over them.
They're hot, Lynn. Be careful.
Yeah. Oh, all the rice on the surface has gotten really crunchy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so soft inside and it's bread-like cakey. And mm-hmm. cakey. But much more interesting than if it was just a straight flour dough.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
So you're ready to help me eat them to save them?
I think so.
Thank you.
Saving is part of my way of life.
If anybody can help me bring the Kellogg back, I know it's you, Lynn.
Well, now we have to spread it around the country.
Thank you.
Thank you, Poppy. These are really dynamite. Really dynamite.
Poppy Tooker hosts Louisiana Eats on WWNO and wrote the Crescent City Farmers Market Cookbook. Now, to hear the rest of our interview where Poppy talks homemade Creole cream cheese and to get her recipes for rice calas and that cheese, check out the website, splendidtable.org. People make pilgrimages to meet Chris McMillan. Now, in a city where cocktail is art, Chris is legend, the bartender of bartenders. He gave us a private lesson in New Orleans' most demanding cocktail, the Sazerac. And he picked the perfect setting. It's a place he co-founded, the Museum of the American Cocktail. Chris is a big, burly guy with the biggest grin. His wife, Laura, who, by the way, is a mean mixologist as well, is petite and blonde. And together they set up our bar on an old whiskey barrel. Very appropriate.
Chris, you've been called a 19th century bartender.
That's an interesting comment on me. You know, as any endeavor, when you want to be good at something, you copy the people who are good at it. And so I've spent the better part of 20 years of my career studying what happened in the past so that I could be good at what I do today. And so American bartending having its roots in the 19th century, I'll take that as a compliment.
So what was happening in the 19th century? I mean, you always think of cocktails as being the 1920s, that's when it really began.
It really begins the 18th century. Americans were spirits drinkers as opposed to beer and wine drinkers because beer and wine didn't travel well from Europe, and we didn't have the raw materials from which to make them. The first time we have the term cocktail defined is in 1806. In a Hudson, New York newspaper, and it defines cocktails as any spirit, sugar, water, and bitters, bitters being the defining ingredient. Without bitters, it would be a category of drink known as a sling, and when you add bitters to it, it becomes a bittered sling or cocktail. Bitters themselves were from a date from really the 18th century in a time that we didn't have medicine as we know it today. The water supply was unsafe to drink. It's not until the 20th century that we have potable filtered water.
Right.
And so we drank alcohol as a substitute for water. And you, upon arising and having your first drink of the day, people would take their bitters as a prophylactic against illness, much the same way we consume vitamins today to protect ourselves from getting sick.
So the drinks that you are making today have their origins back at that time?
This is the cocktail. It's sugar, bitters, and spirit. It conforms to that very basic definition. The prototype would be the whiskey cocktail. Today, we call that the old-fashioned. If you take the fruit out of it, that's what an old-fashioned is sugar, bitters, and spirit. Huh. And, it's believed that sometime in the 1880s, as cocktails became more and more sophisticated and complicated, that somebody said, would you just fix me a cocktail the old-fashioned way? Meaning without all of the extra fruit and things added to them. And that's where the term cocktail The idea comes from.
But now, all this time, you've had a, well, you call it a muddler, but it almost looks like a pestle. And you have these three glasses, and there's a liquid in here that
sugar.
Is this beautiful orange color.
This is clear. Sugar and Peychaud's bitters. Antoine Peychaud was a pharmacist. One of the seminal moments in New Orleans history was the Haitian slave revolt. It was the only successful slave revolt in the history of humanity, and over 80,000 European troops perished in trying to recapture Haiti. I mean, this is Napoleon's army, the finest army in all of the world, because the slaves there fought with total abandon. They had nothing to lose. Well, right. The French, who were the governing body there, when they fled, first went to Havana, and then from there to here to New Orleans. And Peychaud came here to New Orleans, set up a pharmacy on Royal Street, the building which still exists today, and in them created these bitters. His father was a physician, and this was reputed to have been a secret proprietary family recipe. We don't know if that's in fact true, but we do know that certainly by the 1850s, Peychaud's bitters are being advertised as being used in the Sazerac Coffee House, where this drink derives its name. You know, the word Sazerac itself was the name of a very famous brand of cognac produced in the 18th and 19th century, and the coffee house was named after the cognac itself. And as the city made a transition in the 1860s and 1870s to a dominantly American culture, the drink made a transition from being cognac-based to being rye whiskey.
And you've got Wild Turkey.
Because Americans were whiskey drinkers.
So now, this is what I'm wondering about. You've got six glasses here to make three cocktails. And three of those glasses are filled with ice water.
Well, the traditional method for making this drink is to make one drink is to take two old-fashioned glasses, fill with one in ice and water, and allow it to chill.
So these are chilling.
They're chilling, that's correct.
And now you're spooning ice into the glass with the Wild Turkey and the Peychaud bitters.
So we've added our sugar. We saturate it with Peychaud's bitters.
Oh, that's right. You soaked a sugar cube with the Peychaud bitters.
Added a small amount of water to aid in dissolving the sugar cube.
Right.
And to make a solution. We have added the rye whiskey, and we're stirring the drink to chill the drink and to add dilution in water to it. All mixed drinks have a water component to them, and you have to get the right amount of dilution to properly kill the alcohol bite. Now, you don't want it to be watery, but you don't want it to burn either. That's not a pleasant...
This is a very sensitive process.
Well, it's a process that's very prescribed by time. I think I read that one of the bartenders at the Sazerac said that there were like 16 steps to making this drink.
The ice water was just to chill the glasses, and you've poured out the ice water from those three glasses. And what have you just... You've just
put
added
in
a few drops
of absinthe. And we use absinthe almost as a seasoning or flavor. So all I'm doing is coating the interior of the glass and discarding the excess. Smell that lovely...
Oh, yes, anise.
Perfume. And then we're going to strain it, the whiskey and bitters with sugar, into the absinthe rinsed glass.
Ah.
And then the final step is to take a nice piece of citrus peel.
And you've just taken this off of the peel of the lemon. And you're twisting it over the glass.
You can actually look at the top of it. Can you see the oil floating?
Oh, yes.
Floating on the top.
Uh-huh.
And it's just designed. That's the purpose of the twist.
You can smell it.
It's just to give you that lovely citrus perfume. You've got the layers of the whiskey, the sugar, all the flavorings and the bitters, the absinthe, the citrus oil itself. This is a very complex drink with a lot going on to it. Santé, as we say here in New Orleans. Cheers.
Yeah, santé. Oh, this is the subtlest, most complex Sazerac I can remember tasting. Thank you.
Cheers. Thank you so much for coming. It was a pleasure having you.
Chris McMillan, the bartender and born storyteller, has retired. But to see him in action, check out the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, Michael Stern escorts me through road food heaven. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Down the road, Mama won't let me go. I'm sneaking off in my dad's car, far behind the B&B.
Jane and Michael Stern were meant for New Orleans. I mean, it's road food heaven. So it's perfectly logical that they do a road food festival there and that we join them. Their favorite road food places showed up with stands for sampling. 65,000 fans showed up to eat. Well, I managed to rope Michael Stern into being my own personal guide.
This festival is a test of appetite preservation. I mean, you know, there are 30 different great things to eat, and you want to eat a pound of each of them, which is not so easy.
I've never been good at pacing myself.
No, it's really tough. But I think next we should go to Louis Muller's Barbecue from Texas.
All right, let's do that.
This is some smoker, huh?
Not exactly, God.
A backyard smoker.
This is a huge, it's a long, long cylinder with a big square smoking contraption. It's the size of a small trailer. You know, it looks like a locomotive.
Yes, it does, doesn't it?
But there are all these pieces of brisket, and they're charcoal black. What have they done?
They're smoked for about 12 hours. If I'm not mistaken, it has nothing but salt and pepper on it. It's just beef.
Oh, my gosh.
This is Lynn Rosetto Casper from The Splendid Table. This
Hello,
is Wayne Mueller.
Wayne. Thanks for taking a minute.
Wayne was going to shake my hand earlier, but it was all full of brisket juice, so.
Wayne, you're smoking these babies for 12 hours,
yes,
right? And Michael says just salt and pepper on them?
Yes, ma'am. It's a 9-to-1 coarse black pepper to salt ratio.
9-to-1 coarse black pepper to salt?
Yes, ma'am.
They look like they're covered with charcoal.
That's because of the black pepper and the smoke.
But inside is the smoke ring?
Yes, a smoke ring is just a chemical reaction. So in a way, that smoke ring is a bit deceptive. What you're really wanting to look for is how the meat tastes, how the meat feels, and the overall juiciness of that product.
How should the meat feel?
Oh, it should feel like Jell-O.
You say that with the most wonderful, delighted, almost evil grin. Okay, we've got some chunks.
Are we going to taste some now?
Yeah, let's taste some.
Okay. What's great about Louis Muller brisket is it's beef. It's essence, pure essence of beef.
And it's luscious. Oh, that's exactly the right word. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Wayne.
Fabulous.
Now we're going to have a real taste of Louisiana. We're going to eat some crawfish pie.
I've been waiting for this, Michael. I've been waiting. Okay, so this stand is, how do you pronounce it?
Lazione.
Lazione.
Right.
Tell me about the meat pie.
The meat pies are 80% beef and 20% pork, ground and seasoned, and then put in our famous crust and deep fried.
And do these go back along? I mean, tell me about the meat pie in general. I mean, does it go way back?
My dad remembers them peddling them in carts on the side of the road when he was a young boy. And then they kind of died out a little bit. And when he was a butcher, he kind of started concocting his own recipe, and this is what he came up with. And then about 4 years ago, we started making the crawfish pies as well.
It sounds like we should have one of each.
Yes, yeah.
That's the meat. Thank you. This is the meat pie. That has a lot of sense of green pepper in it, and the crawfish are really sweet.
It's very much like etouffee, isn't it?
But the crust is fabulous.
It is really fabulous.
Is there lard in the crust?
I can't tell you.
Or you'd have to kill me, right? Yes.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, this is just fabulous.
Yeah, it really is.
Really delicious.
Lynn, let's go eat some boudin.
Yeah, I haven't had enough protein yet, Michael. Yeah, let's do that.
Okay. Here we are at Johnson's Buccaneer, a smokehouse that's been operating in Lafayette, Louisiana since the 1930s. It's actually below the proprietor's home. They live upstairs. Can you imagine what their interior smells like? But they're most famous for their boudin sausage, which, as you know, is unique to southern Louisiana.
Describe what it is.
It's pork and onions and spices. But beyond that, everyone has their own way of doing it. And the some are very, very spicy and hot. Some are like the comfort food mild. So everyone is different. Should we get a link? And links are kind of fun to eat because you use a knife and fork. You squeeze the meat out of the link.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes. I'd love to do that.
Let's try that.
And what I'm wearing is washable.
Right. This is Lynn Rosetto Casper.
Good to see you.
Likewise.
And we thought we would try a boudin link, okay?
Sure.
I was telling Lynn that you don't use a knife and fork generally. What's the best way to eat a boudin link?
The best way is just to pick it up and squeeze it out and eat it. And then if you have a 6-pack of beer, you have a 7-course meal. So.
Excellent.
Okay, I'm gonna try this.
Me too.
Yeah, all right.
We'll each take half. And
it's
start a squeezing.
It's very hot. Wait a minute.
Oh, my gosh. This is a very, this is a really spicy hunk of boudin.
Is there potato in here?
No potatoes.
Rice.
What
though,
is that?
Right?
Oh, it's rice?
Yes, yes. Rice, celery, onions, a little bit of pork liver as well.
Oh, my.
And then a bunch of green onions. And then we use the broth as well when we stuff it.
This tastes like the most elegant French pâté that's gotten a lot of sexiness added to it.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Thank
really,
you very much.
It's so elegant. Hey, thank you so much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure meeting y'all. You're welcome.
Thanks. Oh, that sauce is such a great compliment for the boudin.
Jane and Michael Stern report on their sleeves-up dining finds on their site, roadfood.com, and here every week. And I think they're still recovering from that weekend in New Orleans.
Do you know what it means to miss New Orleans and miss it each night and day? I know I'm not wrong, the feeling's getting stronger the longer I stay away. Miss the moss-covered vines, the tall sugar pines, where mockingbirds used to sing. And I'd like to see the lazy Mississippi a-hurrying in to spring.
You know, even with all the armchair travel today, I still wanted to make time to talk to you. You know the drill, 800-537-5252. Let's see, who's on the line? Who's been waiting? We have got Fred on the line from Jasper, Texas. Fred, hi.
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
I am good. What's happening with you?
Ah, well, my mother-in-law and I are both into cooking, and so we like to kind of share tips and tricks back and forth. And recently, she said if my tomato sauce was too, if it moved from tangy to acid,
right,
instead of being that nice tangy flavor, and it's got more of that acid afterbite metallic taste to it, that if I added a little bit of cinnamon or nutmeg, it would completely counteract that. Well, I tried it just, you know, for fun.
Right.
And it was great. I love the smoky flavor that it added, but I started wondering why it happens. So I started researching it, couldn't find anything. I did find an article that you had written several years ago about, hey, you should do this, but I don't find the reason why. That's
it's a great question. I can't tell you the science behind it. So my short answer is I don't know. But the long answer is this is a technique that you see used in the Eastern Mediterranean, and occasionally you see it used in Southern Italy where there's been a strong Arab influence in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's something that happens when you add, I guess what I want to say, the warming spices, so clove, cinnamon, allspice, nutmeg, you add any or all of those to a tomato sauce, and there is that sweetening quality, that softness that happens.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because although that happens in other dishes, it particularly blends with the tomatoes. And I think it might be tricky to nail down exactly what's going on because someone, a scientist, told me a long time ago, there are over 300 elements in a tomato that give it its flavor. So it's kind of trying to figure out what are the elements in these spices and what elements are they, you know, acting with in the tomato. But the reality is these are all wonderful additions to tomato sauces. Now, if you're looking at great tradition in quotes in other parts of Italy, if you're doing an Italian sauce, you might not want to add these things because they're not, it's not a taste that's part of the profile of that area. But there is one other thing about makes a sauce sort of acid. Do you cook it a long time?
You know, sometimes I do. Sometimes I cook it for several hours. And then sometimes I'll do something quick, you know, in 10 or 15 minutes, take some crushed tomatoes and just do it up with some garlic and some fresh basil.
Right.
So it really depends on what
I'm
feeling
like. Do you notice a real difference between the two?
I do. I notice a big difference between the two of them.
See, this is the key. Unless you've got meat, you see, or a lot of fat in a sauce when you're doing tomatoes, 10 minutes and you're done. And the other thing is, if you want to really speed up the cooking and keep some of that nice, sweet, fresh quality to the tomato, even if it's canned, you know, it has that quality,
right.
Do it in a skillet and not in a saucepan. So it's spread out and it moves fast. And,
yeah.
And don't cook it too long. You know, grandma having that sauce at the back of the stove, you know, for hours and hours and hours, everybody in her family had heartburn. You know, it really doesn't
so cooking it longer, you're saying,
increases
the more acidic value
now,
of it.
It often what people used to do is they would cook a piece of meat in that sauce, right?
And that's really interesting. I didn't mean to do it that way, but that's, you know, when I do something that's longer, I'm putting meat into it.
That's different because generally, especially if there's a decent proportion of meat to the sauce, then that the fat and the flavor of the meat and all of the other things that are going on with the meat tend to enrich the sauce and it tends not to be as acidic. But if you're just doing the straight tomato sauce, cook it fast.
Fantastic. I'll try that.
Okay.
Thanks so much, Lynn.
You are welcome, sir. Take care. We've got Michelle on the line from Santa Clara, California. Michelle, hi.
Hi, Lynn. Thanks so much for taking my call.
You are welcome.
I recently discovered a local group that divides whole animals from local farmers.
Uh-huh.
So you can share some local meat. And I got my first order of pork. And in my 1/6 of a pig box, when I got it home, I found chops and roasts. But in the bottom of the box was the pig's head. And I have absolutely not a clue what to do with this.
Oh.
Can you help me?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. This is a part of the pig that a lot of people are very standoffish about, but it has, first of all, there's wonderful pâtés that are specifically done with the head. There's a lot of gelatin in that meat and in the skin. And the cheeks are unbelievable in terms of being absolutely succulent when you braise them.
Mm-hmm.
What I would do is I would take the cheeks out, okay? Remove the skin, cut the cheeks up into maybe 1-inch pieces, and I would freeze them because that's going to be fabulous stew. Now, the skin, believe it or not, is a great treasure because the skin, again, has natural gelatin in it. It helps thicken things. It helps make things taste rich. And that bit of fat under the skin is very sweet. And this is what you might add to beans that you stew with or without meat. It's also what the French use constantly in most of their stews to give the stew body and silkiness. So what I would do is take the skin, cut it in maybe 3-inch squares or whatever, and freeze that as well.
Okay.
Now, the snout and all of that, a lot of people use to make a broth with white wine, celery, carrot, and onion, spices like clove, and you could, you know, throw in lots of black pepper. And the idea is that you simmer that very, very, very gently, and it makes its own gelatin. And once you've skimmed off all the fat, that you could add vinegar to and more wine.
Okay.
And you chill it. I put it in like a shallow pan.
Okay.
And then I cut it into little cubes. And that might, you know, go over cold chicken. Or because when you pop those cubes in your mouth, they just melt away. And you get this lovely, luscious flavor.
Interesting.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, yeah. And it's called, a jellied madeleine they were called.
Interesting.
So that thing, you're really going back to the way, your great-grandmas cooked.
Yeah.
Where they wasted absolutely nothing. And any of the meat on that part of the animal, again, that goes with the cheeks, and that's your stew meat, and it's going to have great taste.
Okay, I will stash those away for winter.
And I think you're really courageous, because a lot of people look at a pig's head and they just run from the room screaming.
Well, that's why I called you.
All right.
I ran.
Don't scream. Don't run. You're fine.
All right, thank you so much, Lynn.
Hey, you're welcome, Michelle. Bye. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And you have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this from Mark Twain, who said, "New Orleans food is as delicious as the less criminal forms of sin." The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Now, for more information on anything you heard here today, plus a whole lot more, head to our website, splendidtable.org.
browse our recipes, visit our online store, and get registered for our free podcasts. And you're going to find all the details, you know where, splendidtable.org. Thanks to WWNO, the Road Food Festival, and the New Orleans Convention and Visitors Bureau for all the help in the Big Easy. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Well, we're going to be back next week. You have a good one, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.